Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Friday. It is the 26th of July. I'm Joe Donahue, and we welcome you to the program. We have a lot going on today, so we will get right to it, and we welcome you to be a part of our program. Panel at WAMC.org to get in, panel at WAMC.org. All kinds of cool stuff to talk about today. And we have some really, we have a very special panel, and we look forward to them opining on our world at large in just a moment. I just want to make I mentioned it at the top of the show, but I just like to broaden it a little bit. We have a special coming up at 10:30 this morning. It's a 90-minute audio documentary that we put together on the art and humor of Mad Magazine. There is a fantastic exhibit called What? Me Worry? At the Norman Rockwell Museum in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. And it is a fantastic exhibit. One Sunday morning, when all of you were sleeping, they turned off all the alarms and they let us go in. And we went around and we took a tour and we talked to all the mad artists that were there. And we had just an amazing time. One of the reasons that I'm most proud and most excited about this particular project is that when I saw that it was coming, I immediately thought of my former colleague, Brian Shields, who had been here at WAMC as he hosted every show. But Midday Magazine, Morning Edition, and All Things Considered, he just a terrific broadcaster, 30 years, and then retired in 2019. And I immediately thought of Brian because Brian was always quoting Mad Magazine. I knew that he was a Mad Magazine aficionado. So I didn't know how to get Brian out of retirement, but I called him up. I asked him, I made the pitch, and he was in, and we're very excited. So Brian and I will co-host this special, and it's just great to hear Brian back on the radio again. It's just absolutely fantastic. So I hope you enjoy it. And it's a special coming up at 10:30 this morning. Obviously, we'll be on there as well. And if you get a chance to go to the Norman Rockwell Museum to see this, it is just glorious. It's absolutely a stupendous exhibit. Congratulations to the entire crew there, but especially to the curators, Stephanie Plunkett and Steve Brodner, who worked so hard on it, and to their entire crew for opening up the place to us. It was really quite an experience. So that coming up at 10:30 this morning. I do hope you will join in. That means that we have 90 minutes for our panel, or an hour, 75 minutes for our panel, but that's okay. And we welcome you, as I mentioned, panel at WAMC.org. Let me introduce the panelists to you. Public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois is here. Good morning, Teresa. How are you?
Good morning. Doing well. The Olympics officially start today, so I'm sure people are excited about that because they're having a rough morning in Paris. But good luck to all the athletes. What a wonderful gathering that is.
They'll get their act together by the time it's over. By the time it finishes, it'll be done.
Who doesn't want to be in Paris? So
that's right.
Good luck to all of them. What a wonderful event that is.
Opening ceremonies will be aired tonight, so that's exciting. Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, Jim Henler, good morning.
Morning, Joe.
Nice to see you.
Good to see you, too.
We also,
I'll just let it go.
All right. All right, fine. Feel free to add on later. We also are pleased to have a newbie to the program, and a damn impressive one, too. The president of Wesleyan University, Michael Roth, is here. Hello, Michael. How are you?
Good morning. It's good, actually, to be back. I was interviewed by Alan Chartok many years ago now. Back when I had a book on memory and trauma that came out, and was here at the station then, and listened to you guys every morning, so I'm delighted to be here.
Well, you have a new book out. It is called The Student, and you're going to be talking about that book at the Stockbridge Library tomorrow on the 27th at 3 p.m. And What is The Student about?
The Student, well, the subtitle is very important. It's a short history, so it's not to scare anyone away.
Yes.
It's a history of the idea of the student from the ancient world, the followers of Confucius, Socrates, and Jesus, to contemporary college students and their craziness, their perseverance, their politics, and how they learn. And it's tomorrow I'll be talking about the different stages of the development of the idea of the student.
So I know you wrote a whole book on this, but so not to give away the ending, but do they make them like they used to?
They do. They do make them like they used to. I mean, they used to really want students to be disciples or to be respectful interlocutors. And I think for the last few hundred years, what we've really wanted students to do is to learn how to practice freedom. And practicing freedom with young people leads older people to get very annoyed, jealous, I think, sometimes, or just downright hostile, as we see in the presidential campaign. But practicing freedom has been a long tradition for students. And I think without practicing freedom, you kind of lose it.
Aren't we all students in some respect?
At our best days, I think most of the time people are pretty much stuck in their beliefs and they find things to confirm them. What students do is they learn how to open their mind to new ideas, new ways of thinking, new ways of living. And when they do that, they become more free and I think also better members of communities.
When the semester was over, the school year was over at Wesleyan, did you say, oh, thank God?
You know, it's an interesting thing. I always do, because we have commencement and reunion and lots of intense stuff at the very end of the semester. This year we had an encampment up until a few days before graduation, so it was extra tense. And by now, we're in the middle of the summer, I'm missing my students and looking forward to going back to the classroom and back to being on campus.
We'll talk about some of the challenges that you and other college presidents have as we go through the morning this morning. It's a thrill to have you here. Thank you
very much. It's great to be here.
I really appreciate your time. Again, we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let us talk about items in the news this morning. And we do so. There are some very interesting things that are happening. But I'd like to begin with the polling that is taking place in the election. This is the New York Times Siena poll, and this is one of the first, if not the first, a poll that has been taken after President Biden stepped aside a week ago tomorrow. It was taken after the announcement. Donald Trump and Kamala Harris are locked in a tight race, separated by a single percentage point among likely voters. That is according to the New York Times Siena College poll. If the election were held today, who would you vote for if the candidates were Kamala Trump and Donald Trump? Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. And 47% of likely voters said Kamala Harris, 48% said Donald Trump. But if you look at registered voters, it's 46% for Harris, 48% for Trump. So you lose a percentage point for the Democrats if you look at registered voters as compared to likely voters. The margin of sampling error is 3.4%, which makes this a virtual dead heat. Jim Handler, I need help with numbers. What do I make of this?
So, my fast answer, Joe, is, there have been a lot of critiques of polling and things like that. I think this is certainly encouraging.
Have you been one of those people?
So
I'm not interrupting. I'm just
so one of the things we look at in really looking at the numbers is trends rather than the actual numbers. Right at the moment, things are definitely trending in the right direction. But the other thing is, there's kind of an axiom in polling that nothing settles for 2 weeks. So, we're too close to these days to say much. The other interesting thing in this poll that didn't make sort of the top stories but made some of the other ones was that when they throw in Robert Kennedy, it becomes a dead heat. So he takes two away from Trump and one away from Harris. So, you know, the whole thing is still very, very open. The other thing is, unfortunately, in the American electoral system, depending exactly how you count, somewhere between five and seven states will make all the difference. And it's very specific counties in those states. And so far, there's been no significant polling in those particular places. So the places that are going to make the biggest impact on this election, we're just starting to get some of the feedback from. You know, the excitement among Democrats comes through. Some of the things that also are in this poll is, for example, 87% of the Democrats are now very happy that there is that Biden stepped aside, that we have a designated successor. Almost all of them were favorable to Kamala. So when you see the favorability numbers, right, by party, they look drastically different.
Yeah.
The other thing is, if you add up the 48 and the 47, you'll notice you end up at 95. And that means there's 5% who still haven't made up their mind. And those are really the voters who are going to... So those voters in a small number of places are the ones who are really going to determine this election for a lot of us. And that hasn't even been polled yet. So the way fast answer is, this poll shows a nice movement if you're a Democrat. This poll has to some degree canceled out the post-convention bump that always happens. So Trump had some post-convention bump. Not a lot, just because very few people who were Trump voters were changing their mind.
The Biden change.
But the Biden change had a lot, you know, again, it's just now propagating through.
And what's really interesting about that, I thought, in the poll was that there was so much agreement that it was a good decision.
Yeah.
So whether you were a Trump voter or a likely Democratic voter, there was extraordinary agreement across the country that Joe Biden did the right thing. And that's got to be bad news for Trump when there's extraordinary agreement that your opponent did the right thing in stepping down. That sets the framework for Kamala Harris to have much more success.
I want to hear from Teresa, but let me just ask this question, or to any of you who want to answer it. But when we say that 5% of undecideds, that's an extraordinarily high number, because we have always said in traditional in the last several years of polls that there really were very few undecided voters. There were people that were very firm one way or the other.
I thought it was unregistered.
You know, it's a statistical number. So, you have to get into how the different polls are run and things like that to really get to these things. But the bottom line is that a small number of voters are going to make a difference. The votes in the previous election, 63,000 people, changing their votes would have changed the outcome. I mean, that's a staggeringly small number, given the number of votes that were cast across the nation.
We will never know what is going to happen in November, but we do know that the last several elections have been extremely close. And I have no reason to believe that won't be the case this time. Teresa.
Yeah, I hope I'm consistent on this and that I don't put a lot of stock in these polls until after Labor Day, and this one in particular, because I think that, as Jim noted, that people who poll know that it takes some time for this to settle out, and I think that it's too early. But given that it takes some time to settle out, for those who do put stock in polls, this one would be a good one for the Harris folks, because even without that time to take into account what's happened over the last few days, there's a lot of good news in what I think is an unreliable poll. The polling that I've been trying to do is even less reliable, which is I've been really interested in talking to young people and just individually, and trying to talk to people that I don't know from different places around the country. People have had their their young sons and daughters talk to me, and I talked to three people yesterday, and it's I've been thinking about that a lot because of what happened in those first few days after Vice President Harris announced 38,000 people registered to vote. And a vast majority of them were young people. And they could make a very significant difference in this election. And this election really matters to their future. I mean, every election matters to their future, but I think this one more than most. And what I've heard consistently is, well, the gain consistently, including I talked to yesterday, this very interesting student who's from Connecticut, but right now is in Wisconsin, goes to his school in Madison, and really is, like the other people I've talked to, not that tuned into the news, gets information from what I would consider non-traditional sources, although does see New York Times, but only scrolling, doesn't read the stories, so they doesn't really know a lot about both candidates, but even though doesn't focus on politics, doesn't know a lot about both candidates, has a deep feeling about it, where it's just not Trump. He's nasty, things that he says, doesn't know a lot about him, but you know, doesn't want to go through that again because too much anger, too much hate. Knows very little about Kamala Harris, but is for her. And I think in the last few days, and I've talked to four different people, same thing, the sense of don't know a lot of details, want to learn more, but for her. And I think we really have to understand how people get their information. The other, and this layered...
One minute warning, go ahead.
Layered into something I read yesterday about this now race on to define who she is, and the Trump team putting $68 million in advertising in the next week or so to try to define her, as compared to right now there's $2.6 million in Democrat money for radio buys, advertising buys. And I think that's the real question of these folks who don't, you know, they have a feeling, but they're not really sure. But who's going to define her and what that's going to mean? And how do you get these young people more engaged? The last thing I'll say is the thing that I've heard quite a bit about is they don't want to talk to other people about it because it ends up in an argument. They're just uncomfortable talking politics. And I think, how do we get young people registered, get them talking about politics in a way that's...
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation, I promise. Teresa Bourgeois, Jim Hemler, and Michael Roth with us on this Friday morning. We welcome your input. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll continue after this news break from the BBC.
Sometimes dreams, they don't come true.
Listening to the music of Griffin House this morning, playing at Cafe Lena in Saratoga Springs tonight at 8 p.m. CafeLena.org. CafeLena.org. Welcome back to the discussion. We've been talking about the latest polling, this particular poll from the New York Times and Siena College. And we've been discussing it. Michael, I know you wanted to say something before we went to break.
Yeah, I just think it's important for us to remember that politics isn't a spectator sport. And the most important thing is not these snapshots, but to try to organize people so they go out and vote. And I've been very encouraged by the work that our All Britain Center for the Study of Public Life has been doing on getting newly eligible voters to go out and register. So we have a program called From the Diploma to the Ballot Box. And this is for high school kids who've just gotten their diplomas, who are 18, who are eligible to vote, who probably had no real inclination to register, but they are now registering. And then we make it very easy. We show them how to do that. In Connecticut, we can give this to universities and high schools and across the country, community colleges across the country, to register more people, to get more people not to read polls, but to go out and work on campaigns, whether it's for your school board or the local mayor or the national races. It's so important that we don't just talk about what we read in the paper or see on TikTok, but we go out and talk to people, other citizens, about the public issues that we face. And we do find that young people are ready to do that, especially now that they seem to have a real choice. A lot of them didn't think voting between two old men was a real choice. I think they were wrong about that. There was a real choice there, too. But right now, the energy, because of Kamala Harris's campaigning, because of the views she represents, because of her ability to connect with voters, I think is going to get a lot of young people to vote. And they can make an enormous difference, especially in these swing states.
So it's one thing right now we're seeing an uptick in a lot has been made about TikTok with the Harris campaign and young people. The not only TikTok, but the money that is being raised via TikTok is quite impressive. The people who have become engaged. But then there always seems to be, at least in our history, there's always been a gap between that excitement and people who actually go out and vote. So how do you bridge that gap?
That's called organizing, right? That's what we have to do. We have to train trainers to go out and organize folks to not just express their opinions through a pollster, but to get to the polls. And we all know that in many of these states, it's extremely difficult to cast your vote. You have to wait for hours. In Georgia, there's the famous no water online law, and there are many impediments to voters. But we've also seen in American history that people make enormous sacrifices, sometimes paying with their lives for the right to vote. And I think what we have to remind young people and people of all ages that the right to vote is an extraordinarily important thing to hold on to. And we know it's being threatened by Trump and his allies, that they would discourage voting. What we have to do in response is encourage voting, whoever you're going to vote for, but to defend our ability to get to the polls and to cast votes for the people we believe should be our leaders.
On the campus of Wesleyan University, how difficult / easy is it for a student to vote?
Really, has been really easy. Because we had a polling place on campus for the last several years, and our voting numbers are very high. We belong to Campus Compact, which is a great organization all over the country getting young people to vote. We're also involved with the Institute for Citizens and Scholars, which has created a network of dozens, really now scores of university presidents around the country who have said three basic things: that participating in the electoral system is good for the individual student, it's good for the school, and it's good for the country. And if that's the case, then we should be getting our students to participate in politics, whether they are at a community college or a big state university or at a private university like Wesleyan.
And let me just throw in the addition that, you know, for a lot of our schools, so a state school, you know, pretty much the students are in that state. For a lot of the privates, for Wesleyan, RPI, others, right, one of the things that is really important to our students is making sure they understand they can get a mail-in ballot and that counts. And that's, in fact, I think, why a lot of states are trying to get rid of these mail-in ballots, because, you know, if I have to fly from my university, you know, back home
to vote.
Vote and back. And by the way, most universities don't, you know, take 4 days off around election day and can't. You know, that's, I think, one of the reasons why mail-in voting and absentee voting becoming easier is so important.
Yeah.
Really changes the youth vote.
And we have these forms that show people how they can register either in the state where they're going to school or in their home state. And I think that encouraging young people not just to vote, but actually to get involved and participate in politics. Absolutely. And I think one of the things that Kamala Harris has done, so surprising in a way, is that there's a vibe that it's fun to actually engage in politics. Right. This brat campaign, that the dancing stuff, that actually being part of a political movement can be joyful, can be energizing, and it can make a difference.
And she's really leaning into that. One of the things, when I worked at RPI, it was a group of interns in one area where I would go and talk with them. There were about 10 or 12 of them in this area. And one day I went in and just said, okay, how many of you are registered to vote? I think maybe one or two of them. And so we made a plan to register and had them sit down on their computers. It's okay, let's figure it out. Let's register. They decided, are they going to register in New York, or if that wasn't their home state, where they were going to register, totally up to them. But then they were really encouraging each other to do it after we started talking about it. And I think that that sort of, okay, is anybody else, you know? And they came back and reported that they'd gotten other people to register. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of influencer it can influence the behavior. But one of the things that I thought interesting, again, actually this person one of the people I spoke with yesterday was from Wisconsin, and he was saying how he knows that Wisconsin is a key state. Now, here's a person who's not really focused on politics mm-hmm. at all, but aware enough that he said he knew it was important that he vote this time because of how important Wisconsin was, which I found fascinating that he really didn't know a lot of the issues, but he knew enough about that. But the other thing that I've heard consistently in trying to talk to young people is this issue, when you hear from older people too. No, I don't talk to my friends about politics because I don't, you know, it can become uncomfortable. I don't want to, you know, ends up in an argument. So the question is, how do you help people feel comfortable talking with other people of their same age about these issues when it's become so polarized, become so caustic?
That's a great question, although sometimes maybe you don't want to get involved in it.
Well, I think that the tenor of political conversations in the U.S. over the last decade especially has become so charged with nastiness. And clearly, Trump has created a climate where you get rewarded for nastiness in ways that certainly happened before, you know, with negative advertising. But there's a kind of showmanship of nastiness that he's perfected that lots of people enjoy. But if you're the target of it, you know, if somebody calls you a frustrated cat lady in the lunchroom, that's not all that pleasant. And your response is to be meaner in return. That's terrible. So I think colleges and universities have a responsibility, high schools too, to actually cultivate conversations across difference and develop, you know, this great American tradition of pluralism that people like Eboo Patel have been talking about. We have to get back to that, where people can say, yeah, we don't agree, and we're going to have a meal together, we're going to have a beer together, and we're going to talk about things we don't agree about. It has happened many times in our history. It can happen again.
You know, the other thing I find interesting, Joe, and people who listen to this show know that I'm quite torn about the whole issue of Israel, Gaza, et cetera. But the college campus encampments and things like that, which I think are very problematic in some ways, interestingly have been bringing students into politics. They're paying attention to an issue, which starts them talking about other issues, so I think some of that student apathy that I was seeing a few years ago, this issue has pushed that. And then building on top of this issue has been a lot of stuff on the Roe versus Wade and those things, because of course that's something they're going to have to live through in the next 5-10 years for many of them, and or already in some cases. So this really is, you know, an interesting thing to say that there's a positive out of this particular issue that I really wish was more carefully being aired. But again, the one thing I think it really is doing is it's engaging a whole different community in thinking about the impact of politics.
Well, one of the jobs I had along the way, I spent 3 years in the mid-80s working for a public policy think tank. It was a bipartisan group, and the idea was we had these role-play simulation games, bring together people of opposite views or various views, go through a role-play exercise, and then have a discussion after that, often with their elected official. It was on the global spread of nuclear weapons. There was one on the budget process, a whole range of issues. And it was interesting because they did go through this role-play simulation. They would begin to understand. It was a way to, in a, sort of a neutral way, to talk about, understand other people's points of view and engage in that conversation. But that's, you know, that's not happening on a regular basis. But I do think that, I mean, I remember when I was in college, we had a good time talking about, well, I guess I was wonky about politics back then too, but you didn't hesitate to have a conversation about politics, but it wasn't acrimonious in the way that it has been since the Trump time. And the other thing that I've really begun thinking about is that there's some people who all they know is an era when Trump was president, right? Or Trump was in on the scene, which is very different than it had been. And I'm not a historian, but very different than it had been in the past. And this very caustic language, you know, like, as he said the other day, you know, they said I was going to be nicer, but I don't want to be nice,
right?
And how
Trump said that at a rally.
And how do we have these conversations and let people explore different ideas and share their views and really think through them in a way that's safe and comfortable.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we have letters on this. We'll go to the letters, then we'll change the subject as well. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
Just for me.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Jim Hendler is here. Teresa Bourgeois, and Michael Roth, the president of Wesleyan University. He has a new book out called The Student, A Short History. And he will be at the Stockbridge Library on July 27th, which is tomorrow, if you check your calendar, at 3 p.m. And this is somehow put on by Chesterwood. Is that how that works?
Yeah, Chesterwood is sponsoring it, and they're using the Stockbridge Library as a venue, which is very
wonderful.
Nice of everybody.
So you can find out more by going to chesterwood.org. Chesterwood.org.
What is Chesterwood?
Chesterwood is the home of Daniel...
Chester French.
Who was the sculptor for the Lincoln Memorial.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
And poetry readings and musical events and book things like this one.
Oh, great. Yeah, I thought of him as a... Yeah, okay.
Excellent. We welcome all of you. Thank you very much. We also welcome our listeners, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let us go to some letters on the polls. Mark says, one of your panelists said that young people don't like to talk about politics because it leads to arguments. I've heard this before, of course, but it suddenly occurs to me this morning that when I was in college in the 70s, I was opinionated and annoying and loved to argue. I used to come home and pick fights about the war with my dad. I don't think I was unusual. I'd be interested in whether your, quote, history of studenting panelist, that would be you, Michael, has any thoughts on this. Is it a real difference?
I think there are some differences. People still like to argue with their parents. I think that's goes a long way.
Oh, those universal things.
But I do think that there's some fear of being canceled, that these things occur on social media. But I also see in my classes people argue all the time about politics. And I think in some classes a professor will give a student a card and they have to argue their own view. If they get a red card or they get a blue card, they have to argue somebody else's view. And nobody knows what card you have, and it creates these really interesting, intense discussions. I think the encampments led to lots of interesting, sometimes intense discussions. When students realize that many of their friends are going to be threatened with deportation if Trump wins, they will be very much energized to argue against that kind of deportation. So I think that the emphasis on the fear of students to disagree or self-censorship, I think it's really overblown. I think you can, as a teacher or as a university administrator, create environments in which students feel perfectly comfortable arguing. They certainly argue with me all the time. Sometimes they actually take over my office. And they're very happy to make sometimes careful arguments, sometimes loud arguments, and sometimes both.
Jason?
Yeah, I find this, I try to listen very carefully when I hear this because I've heard it consistently now, because when I was young, I was in Washington and I had a group every Friday night. Many Friday nights get together for dinner, people of all backgrounds and, you know, different views. And we do the issue one and talk about an issue, and everybody would discuss it and disagree, and then issue two and issue three. You know, we usually have three or four or five issues we talk about, but we would arrive as friends, we would leave as friends, and in the middle of it, we would have strong, strong disagreements, much like used to happen on the floor of the House and Senate.
But don't we always? So, I mean, this sort of goes back to I had parents who were brought up in the Depression, and so while we had really good conversations, and I'm a product of the conversations that my parents had, there was still, I think they were coming out of a, you don't talk about politics, you don't talk about religion, and of what was sort of acceptable chat. What happened in the House when you had these discussions at dinner was different than if you went to Mrs. Murphy's house, for example.
So, I grew up in the 60s and 70s movements. I was political enough to get, beat up by cops in various very large crowds. But what I notice in the students is at that point, they pretty much all agreed on stuff. And a lot of the political discussion was very explicit. And then you had a Kent State, and then you had things like that. So there were a lot of things to mobilize around. I think over the period of the past 12, 15, I can't tell you how long. I've been a professor for 40 years. But the students, when they interact with each other, don't tend to be talking politics. I'm not sure whether it's discomfort, it's other things they talk about. Obviously, I'm on STEM campus, so it's
right.
Very different.
RPI's
but when different. I talk to, but when I talk to my colleagues, who are at much larger schools, the state schools, some of those state schools in states that are, very, very red, they're saying pretty much the same thing, which was there just weren't the issues that were motivating these kids, and just fighting over who to vote for didn't go anywhere.
Right.
Now, there are real issues starting to come back, but I think it's going to take, we're seeing a culture shift in the students' willingness to interact with each other, but it's not there yet. And some of the issues, trans rights, white supremacy, things like that, make people very uncomfortable because they feel they can't portray one side of it or the other.
Okay. You also see some very good organizing around some issues, like certainly around climate.
Yep.
There's a lot of organizing that's
grown
from young people, and
guns,
certainly around guns. I was listening to David Hogue last night. He organized from Florida. He was one of the people who organized
Parkland.
Major marches. Yeah, Parkland, thank you.
Yep.
And he was saying that their group of young people raised $365,000 two days ago, and again, got people focused on the issues because they think this election is so important. And the thing is, there are so many issues in this election that are critical to people of all ages, but particularly to the young people. And the question is, how do you engage them and then get them engaged? And I wonder if there are young people listening right now who can call and tell us.
We actually offer
don't
a
call.
Mini...
I'm sorry, write and tell us.
Yeah,
see,
ahead,
I make
right.
mistakes.
That's
I'm
right.
so
go
sorry.
Ahead.
We offer mini grants to students who want to go and spend a weekend knocking on doors in Pennsylvania or Georgia or wherever they want. In Wisconsin and work on campaigns. And the great thing about that is when you knock on somebody's door, you don't know what you're going to get. Wesleyan, you knock on somebody's door, there's a range of opinions that's pretty defined. And we've had many students who go off to work on campaigns around the country where they will interact with people who have very different views, different concerns, and they do fine. They're perfectly capable of doing this. And I think the myth of the coddled student who is not able to deal with disagreement is way overblown. I've seen incredibly interesting arguments among students and between students and invited speakers around free expression, around art issues, around politics. And I think it's just a question of framing it in such a way the students are encouraged to do that rather than just pursue a degree which will land them the best internship possible.
We had in 1984 at a high school program that put students out on the streets signing people up to vote. And in 88, I did it through a college program. Mm. I find that along with serving on a jury, to be one of the most formative experiences of my life, talking to people about voting and about why they were voting, why they weren't voting, the problems. For a sobering fact, when you're 16, 17 years old and you knock on a door and you say to somebody, would you like to fill out this form? And they say, oh, can you help me out because I can't read and I can't write. So then you learn all kinds of things.
Yeah.
And you learn things about your neighborhood. You learn things about neighborhoods and
Absolutely.
Areas and also, obviously, about politics and what people are thinking. It's an amazing opportunity.
And meet fascinating people. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. It's just I want to say, you got to look at the numbers, right? The numbers, I mean, what percentage of that age group is even in college? Mm-hmm. What percentage of that group in the colleges are involved in these programs? Which, you know, again, I think getting much more of this kind of thing into high schools, in finding ways to reach out to the high school dropout level. I mean, that's where a lot of these issues hit. That's where a lot of these people don't have a community they're involved in. And I think, you know, social media has become the way to do that, and that's become very fractured. And so, a lot of us who study social media and are looking at ways to broaden it see this as a real potential area, because that number far outweighs the number of people we're talking
about. And expanding the pool. I mean, you're obviously targeting some key people in key states that swing voters. But if you expand the pool, then you dramatically increase your chances.
I was going to say that we have 3 minutes and three letters, but these letters are enormous. So I will we'll probably get to one, and then we'll get to the other two on the other side. When I say enormous, there's a lot to say about them. Diane says, so how about when Kamala in a speech says young people 18 to 24 are stupid? You want college kids to go vote for her? This is a viral clip that has been going around over the last 24 to 48 hours. The remark was widely fact-checked in 2020 when Harris rose to vice president. It is a 2014 address when the then California Attorney General described her Back on Track program. Her initiative aimed to prevent criminals from becoming repeat offenders by working with young adults charged with first-time low-level selling charges. We designed this program around 18 through 24-year-olds mostly, but it was usually up to 30 years old, Harris said on Back on Track. When I was at Howard University and we were in college, we were 18 through 24, and you know what we were called? College kids. But when you turn 18 and you're in the system, you are considered an adult, period. She went on to criticize the decision-making process of this age group. This is why we put them in dormitories and they have a resident assistant. They make really bad decisions, so we focused on that age population. And this is according to Snopes.
So, of course, everybody knows that college students make bad decisions from time to time. And one of the ways, when I say that students practice freedom, one of the things you do when you practice freedom is you do stupid stuff. That's if you're not doing anything wrong and you're 19 years old, you're acting like an old fart, and that's a mistake. And so I met with Kamala Harris when she was a district attorney in San Francisco about programs for youth, and I never met with a public official who was more dedicated to finding vehicles for young people, especially from underserved communities, to get on track to not be in an underserved community eventually. So I think this is a red herring.
And that's a great program that she created, a great program, which she should be applauded for.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
I
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We have a good one underway. Teresa Bourgeois, Jim Hendler, and Michael Roth, president of Wesleyan University, joining us for the first time on the panel, and we are thrilled to have him here. Michael is the author of the new book, The Student, A Short History. And he will be talking about the book at the Stockbridge Library tomorrow at 3 p.m. And you can find out more by going to chesterwood.org, chesterwood.org. So let's talk a little bit, if we can, about higher education. And I will put this in the form of a news item, which is that of the current Democratic, we will say front runner, according to the polls, Democratic front runner, because there is nobody else, Vice President Harris and the higher education agenda. And the information that I'm reading to you is from Inside Higher Ed, and it talks about how Kamala Harris could become the first HBCU graduate in the Oval Office and would likely build on the Biden administration's ambitious higher ed standards. It's not yet clear how or how much a President Harris may differ from Biden on higher education policy. Like most vice presidents, she's generally been in lockstep with the president and championed the administration's policies. She's pushed its efforts to forgive student loans and make payments more affordable for borrowers. As a senator, she signed on to legislation to make community college free, also a Biden proposal, and help colleges pay for students' basic needs, such as food, housing, and transportation. Prior to that, as Attorney General for California, she uncovered predatory practices at some for-profit colleges and pushed for cancellation of loans taken out by students who were defrauded. Michael, what do you make of the Democratic platform on this issue, but also what we assume will be the President Harris agenda.
Yeah, well, there's a really stark choice. Senator Vance says we should make war on universities, and Trump has made no secret of his pride in his own Ivy League credentials, but his disdain for people who read or spend time in education. That contrasted with the Biden-Harris proposals, which will make it easier for people without economic resources to attend a community college or to find their way to public institutions. They've also been very much in favor of expanding the Pell Grants, which give students the ability to choose a school they want to go to and have some financial support along the way. Pell Grants used to account for the majority of the cost of tuition, and now probably less than a third in most places. But still, that's an important vehicle for making education more accessible to more Americans. And I think that has been really important to Biden. It's really important to the country. Student debt relief is I think, crucial because of the ways in which the federal government has subsidized predatory lenders and put many millions of students at a disadvantage. I think debt relief that takes into account who needs it most, that is, that poor people should get debt relief first and they should get complete debt relief. I think that's really crucial. And my sense is that Vice President Harris is that's her position as well. But, you know, I think having a more educated citizenry, education very broadly conceived, I mean, it doesn't have to be a fancy places with fancy degrees, but having a more educated citizenry is better for the country as a whole. It's better for the polity. It's better for the economy. It'll help us create a culture of innovation, but also a culture of more fairness and more compassion. So I think that the war on universities that Senator Vance has promised, despite his own leap through the Ivy League, is in real contrast to what we would have from a new administration from Vice President Harris.
Jim.
I Other than saying, here, here, I don't want to do that. That's exactly right.
We're afraid to argue. What's the matter here?
No, I mean, you know, the Republicans, frankly, are afraid of education because it encourages critical thinking. And there's a pretty good evidence that not so much that it skews people Democratic, but it makes people more willing to pay attention to more issues. So you lose the one-issue voters. And for many, many years, the Republicans have had the gun issue, the abortion issue, several other things where people would vote solely on that issue and nothing else. And I think more education causes you to see that these things are connected, that there's gray areas, things like that. So I absolutely agree. And it's at every level, all the way down. The notion that Vance and Trump would kill off Head Start is just insane.
So I'd like to ask you both a question. The Republican platform, and this is also in Project 2025, which they, you know, they deny any knowledge of, even though 140 of their staffers and close associates were involved in drafting it. But page 13 of the Republican platform, return education to the states. We are going to close the Department of Education in Washington, D.C., and send it back to the states where it belongs and let the states run our education system as it should be run. So just as a university president, what would happen if they closed the Department of Education?
The people have been calling for closing the Department of Education since the Reagan administration, and I think these are buzzwords that are meant to get the base riled up. Let me acknowledge a problem that the Republicans dealing with here, which is that in many, especially fancy colleges, universities, but also at the big flagship public universities, you have a culture that becomes, in many cases, a monoculture. That is a place that there's not enough intellectual diversity. There's not enough debate across lines. That the professoriate is skewed extraordinarily greatly to the left, and so this becomes a talking point for Republicans because on campuses you don't have enough conservative or religious members of the faculty, and that gives students pause who might lean in that direction to participate fully. So I think, and we've been talking about this at Wesleyan for the last dozen years or so, I do think that colleges and universities have an obligation to be a more welcoming place for people of all political persuasions who are willing to engage in nonviolent conversation about the issues, and to be a place that's hospitable to people of religious faiths to want to talk about questions of faith, of community through belief. These are some things that universities have become less able to deal with, I think, in a holistic way. And we need at universities to become places for that value intellectual diversity and don't just value the people that agree with us in our political views.
I agree with all of that, but I want to go back to this notion of his rhetoric around closing the Department of Education, because he says it all the time. It generates big cheers at his rallies. It's nonsensical, but I think it's part of this anti-government, anti-university.
Yes. Yeah.
And I don't think that most people understand that it's through the Department of Education that you get essential data. It's through the Department of Education that there's a whole series of things that you get. And I think this bashing the government, bashing government workers, thinking of them as a deep state, I just think it's unhealthy for our system and it shouldn't go unchecked. Also, there's a line here which I don't quite understand, but it says accessible higher education. To reduce the cost of higher education, Republicans will support the creation of additional drastically more affordable alternatives to a traditional four-year college degree. And I read that and I think, well, Trump University, how did that go, right? So in any case. And then there's a section on I just think that there needs to be some pushback. There's also on artificial intelligence, Jim. We will repeal Joe Biden's dangerous executive order that hinders AI innovation and impose radical left-wing ideas on the development of this technology. In its place, Republicans support AI development rooted in free speech and human flourishing. And all I think of is this the line for Elon Musk, is that where he's getting his $43 million from?
That's probably. I mean, you know, the answer is this.
What is human flourishing?
Beats me. banning books that cause you to feel uncomfortable.
It sounds pleasant, but
the no, I mean, it would take hours to correctly answer a lot of these issues. But really, the whole question, here's a quick analogy. 20 years ago, we screwed up on regulation of social media. To make it grow, we put a line in one law that said they can pretty much do anything they want. We now regret that heavily, right? With AI, the Biden administration and others have been trying to get out in front of this. Big tech has actually been willing to engage in that discussion. It's really been the Republicans who have somehow come up with this notion that social media is anti-conservative that have caused the problem. The interesting thing about it is every study on social media has tended to show it more biased towards conservative things, especially when you get into some of the ones that people haven't heard so much about, 8chan, 4chan, some of these things. We've done deep analyses of these things. And, I mean, it's staggering the difference between conspiracy theories in, you know, some of these medias and things. And there's no control because we blew it.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important with AI that we at least start to build a position so that 20 years from now, we're not trying to backfill and figure out how the hell did we get in this trouble.
I should say just a word, another word about the Department of Education. No. The Secretary of Education is from my neck of the woods in Connecticut, and he comes from the K-12 side of education, and that's where, although states and towns and cities have control of their own school districts, it's so important that we create a national program to increase literacy rates, to increase the ability of students to deal with statistics and numbers more generally. We are so far behind. I mean, yes. We've been talking about colleges and universities, but we're so far behind in the K-12 world where students who don't learn to read by the third grade, they're condemned to a likely life of poverty because right. They don't have the skills to participate in the economy. And it doesn't have to be that way with the only industrialized country in the world that has failed so badly at this. And we can do that with federal support of local control of schools in the K-12 area.
You know, if I can make a quick quick note, I'm on the board of a local charity, and one of the programs we supported very, very heavily, in fact, had named after my mom, is called The Race to 10,000. Mm-hmm. And it's because a middle-class kid entering kindergarten typically has about a 10,000-word vocabulary. A kid who's grown up in a disadvantaged household is lucky to have 1,000. And it's just simple things like teaching the parents to... One of the field trips, you go to a grocery store and tell the parents to read the kid the names of the different fruits and the different... I mean, you know this is
human flourishing.
This really is human flourishing.
In Boston,
it makes such a difference.
There was a doctor, a pediatrician in Boston, who he took a closet, turned it into a little library, and he would write a prescription for kids when they left. They were prescribed to go get a book,
which
I thought, isn't that fabulous?
Yeah.
And one time we had a round table. I worked for Mayor Flynn, and he just wanted to hear from his staff, you know, what kind of initiatives we should have, and he could give whatever. And I said, Boston Mayor Ray Flynn.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Joe.
No problem.
Everybody read by third grade. My mother taught me that. You've got to be able to read by third grade, and there should be a push to do that. In a case, yeah.
Okay, we have just a few moments, and I would like to get to one final subject because we haven't talked about it a lot this week, although it's certainly very much in the news and on the table, and that is while the dust is settling over the decision by President Biden to withdraw from the race, that means that Vice President Kamala Harris is getting ready for... my favorite word, veep steaks. And so considering top Democrats for her running mate, Governors Roy Cooper of North Carolina, Josh Shapiro of Pennsylvania, Tim Walz of Minnesota, Andy Beshear of Kentucky, Senator Mark Kelly of Arizona. Just a few of the names on the list. As the New York Times called it today, a buffet of white guys. to choose as the number two, we were told, CNN reported, I believe yesterday, if not the day before, that we would know within the next 12 days or so.
I think we'll know by August 7th, well, before August 7th, because by August 7th, the DNC is going to have the roll call vote.
Right.
The virtual meeting, and they said it'll be done by then. It's a really great bench. I mean, that's the thing that's so interesting, a real diverse group of people, a really great bench. I will just say, as people have heard me now for a month or more, I really think that Senator Mark Kelly of Arizona is what this ticket needs. He's got stellar credentials. He's decorated military. He's an astronaut. He's an elected official. He works across the board. He has foreign policy experience, which I think will be helpful. He has invaluable experience.
You're not worried about the Senate?
Yeah. Well, no, because exactly. It's a Democratic governor. The governor's a Democrat, and so he will be replaced by a Democrat. And then that person would have to run in 2 years.
2 years.
But he'd have 2 years to do so. I really think that I think because his background is different than hers, but we'll see. I mean, and I think Arizona's going to be a key state. And the question, I think, boils down to chemistry. Will they have chemistry? And that, I don't know. I don't know if they'll have chemistry. But I think that it's
a... Boy, that would be a great ticket.
I'm for the astronaut, really.
He has a bumper sticker.
Literally global perspective. And he's gotten a lot of good buzz.
Well, and you have, I mean, you obviously have that aspect to it, but you also have the border aspect.
Yes. Well, I think that's key because he was among those negotiating the bipartisan agreement at the border and gave a very powerful speech after when it didn't go through and really condemning Trump and all of those who followed Trump. And because he said, here we have a solution that we haven't been able to get to for a long time, not to mention... if you talk about political violence and the repercussions, if you have all this hate speech, his wife is the extraordinary Gabby Giffords, mm-hmm. and who is a victim of political violence. And I've also heard him talk on the reproductive health issue, which he speaks very powerfully on, too. Talks about personal experience with IVF and about he has daughters and a granddaughter and what about their future. He's very powerful on that issue. He's been to Ukraine. He's met with Zelensky. He's a fighter pilot. He's met with Ukrainian fighter pilots. I mean, he just has a pretty broad background. So, okay, enough cheering section for him. But
is there anyone on that list that you would object to?
Well, I think that, I think Roy Cooper from North Carolina, I would not object to him. I think he is a strong contention because how important North Carolina is. Apparently, he is close to Harris, but he doesn't have foreign policy experience. I think Shapiro, though, he's very strong. I just don't think he has, and people love him. I think he'll be important in the campaign anyway, but I just don't think he has the breadth of experience. I think he like Wes Moore of Maryland, the governor of Maryland. I think both of them are rising stars. They're awesome.
First term governor.
Yeah,
right.
So I just don't think, I think both of them are people to really watch for the future, just like Whitmer, Governor Whitmer in Michigan. But I think not yet. I think they're all going to be invaluable. What's amazing is the range of people on the bench, right, is incredible.
Yeah,
and Buttigieg and
Kelly as well.
Kelly,
yeah.
But I think you know, an astronaut, that's out of this world. Let's go for him, but we'll see.
Gabby Giffords was a student of mine when she was an undergraduate at Sir Ian Scripps College many years ago.
Wow.
And I agree with everything you said, although I think Governor Shapiro would bring a lot to the ticket. But I think that if they can, Senator Kelly would be a wonderful addition.
I think you need the foreign policies, you know, and I think the people even who are not that focused on politics, if you military vet, astronaut, you just have a sense of confidence and leadership, ability to compromise. He's a middle of the road guy. The unions like
You'd
him.
You'd love to see him debating Senator Vance.
Oh, that's buy tickets to that show.
Tim?
Which, I agree.
But, you know, Buttigieg, but I just Buttigieg, but they'll all be great surrogates. Yeah. I mean, that's the other thing. Whoever, even if he doesn't get picked, even if it's Cooper or, but all great
surrogates.
Well,
when surrogates. You have, in the 2 or 3 minutes that we have left, when you have somebody like Gretchen Whitmer who says, well, I don't really want to be included in this discussion. I mean, there are, if for people who are thinking about their political futures, there is a decision to be made here of if you want to put yourself into that fray.
And maybe making the calculation, 2 women on the ticket, that's not happening, and so pause and say I'm all in. But also there's a southern strategy that they're talking about that Kelly really weighs into, because the northern strategy, the blue wall, is a typical strategy where it's Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, right? And that gets you there. But as some people are speculating that for Harris, it might be equally advantageous to the southern strategy, which is North Carolina, Georgia, Arizona, Nevada, mm-hmm. and that he's beloved there. He also, the McCain family, he's close to the McCain family,
yes.
And so I think that that's a good route to take.
And then once you make the decision, of course, then there'll be the convention, and that's where we'll start to see the gelling process.
Right, right. And with all of them, except for Buttigieg, I mean, you know Buttigieg is good in the media. You know he's good. The other person who's emerged to be very good in the media is the governor of Minnesota, an educator.
Yeah.
He's really good on TV, but I think he doesn't have the name recognition. But all of these folks are fantastic.
All right. Well, we got to a lot today. We got some. I just want to go to a couple letters as we close out our time together. That is, dear panel, regarding our civil discourse or lack thereof, there is a grassroots nonpartisan organization of volunteers leading the new movement to stop the polarization, which has been tearing our country apart. It's called Braver Angels, founded in 2017.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
All right.
Thank you for
them there. It's a great, great group. Great
Thank
group.
You for that letter.
Republicans are realizing the only way that they can win is to change what intelligence is. If you can make a conspiracy for as many truths as possible, then anyone can be quote-unquote intelligence. Attack on college institutions is all part of the plan. That from Andrew.
And we see evidence of that in our studies of social media dynamics and stuff, which we'll talk about some other time. Maybe on one of the Vox Pops.
The things that Elise Stefanik did, I think, are so, I mean, having a Ivy League person who attacks the, it's abhorrent.
My thanks to all of you for being with us this morning. It has been, you guys are all great.
This was fun.
Teresa Bourgeois, Jim Hendler, and Michael Roth, thank you so much for being here. Michael is president of Wesleyan University. He'll be talking about his book, The Student, at the Stockbridge Library tomorrow at 3 p.m., chesterwood.org for more information. Michael, what a great pleasure. We look forward to having you back.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Really wonderful. We will be back as we present our Mad Magazine special coming up after this.